Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. It was one thing choosing a college in good times, when there were jobs and maybe some savings and colleges themselves were flush with cash. But now, this year, it's different. Millions, including parents with seniors in high school, have lost jobs or fear they could. Savings have been chewed up in the market crash, college endowments too. It's more complicated choosing this time for everyone. This hour, On Point, with acceptance notices out, we're looking at college choices in hard times. You can join the conversation. Is your family having tough conversations about this right now? Parents, students, how are you thinking about the choice of a college in economic tough times? In a moment, we'll hear from the provost of one of the country's top public universities and from a top education reporter. Joining us first from San Francisco is Stephen Yoder, San Francisco bureau chief for the Wall Street Journal. His 18-year-old son, Isaac, will be heading off to college next fall. They write the Yoder and Son column about parent-teen money issues for the Wall Street Journal. Stephen Yoder, it's been a long time since we last chatted. Welcome. Great to have you.
Hi, Tom. Nice to talk to you again. I think the last time we saw each other was under the cherry blossoms in Tokyo at a hanami party back in the 1980s.
Long ago, far away in sweet times, and here we are now. You've been around this track before. You've got an older son who's already in college.
That's right.
How's it different this time with Isaac, Stephen?
Well, the first time with my older son, he had a fairly well-focused idea of what he wanted to do. He wanted to go into an engineering school, a small liberal arts engineering school. And I told him, well, find the best choice for yourself, and then we'll look at the costs afterwards. And the Dow was at about 13,000, so that was a high-minded thing to do. Well, with Isaac, at the beginning of last year, he began to look at colleges. The Dow was more like 12,000. Mm-hmm. I told him the same thing. He decided that he wanted a small liberal arts college, academically challenging liberal arts college. Mm-hmm. And I said, well, find the best choice for you. Narrow it down to a few on your top list, and then we'll think about the money later.
We'll worry about the money later.
That's right.
And then?
And then the fall came, and the Dow was about 11,000, and we started visiting colleges. And I said, well, maybe we ought to worry about it a little bit more, but let's wait until your acceptances come in, and then we'll worry about it. And now his acceptances are coming in, and now we have more to worry about.
The Dow at 7,000. You must have had some of your college savings in there, I guess, from the way you're looking at that.
Absolutely. We had probably a year's worth at a small liberal arts college in a 529 plan that I thought was fairly prudent but proved imprudent.
And it's not just the Dow. I mean, job losses are all over the place. Journalism certainly not immune from that, your own employer included. I mean, everybody, I'm sure your job is very secure, Stephen, but everybody looks over their shoulder these days.
That's absolutely right. And obviously, any of us in this business has to worry a little bit more about our jobs, including me. This is a worry that Isaac brings up with me all the time. And we get a lot of letters from people asking what should they do now. I just got a letter yesterday from a woman responding to our column yesterday saying that her son got into a lot of wow universities he never expected to get into, but they're in the $35,000 to $50,000 range, and she's not sure she can pay for it. What should she do? And I'm sometimes hard-pressed to be able to tell people.
Well, I mean, that's a range that you know from your first son in college. That is a lot of money. How's Isaac looking at that now? Is the economic factor coming into his decision-making? And how are you looking at it? Have you drawn a boundary around what he ought to be considering, Steve?
Well, at this point, our feeling is that we'll still be able to honor our commitment to him to send him where he wants to go. However, the financial aspect of it will play a bigger role, I think, than it did with his older brother, Luke. Isaac's gotten into a number of great colleges. He's on the waiting list for at least one more that he'd like to be into. And in the end, we're going to have to sit down and look at, all things else being equal, which offers the best financial package. And that's something that we didn't anticipate having to do, and that's something that we talk about almost every night, including last night until about 1 in the morning.
Now, your older son, and this must be a common situation in American families right now, an older child who's already in college. It's an expensive college, certainly not a cheap one. Is there a fairness issue here? Do you feel, well, since we sent our first child in good times to an expensive school, we've got to be ready to do that for our younger child, and you've still got one more coming, so that to think about. But or is economic reality at a point now where, you know, everybody has to kind of smell the new coffee here, Stephen?
That's what a lot of our readers are telling us, that we need to smell the coffee. Our feeling still is that there is a fairness issue and that we've been basically saving since we were first married, and that's 30 years ago, for this, because I went through college. I had to pay a good deal of my own college tuition.
Me too.
And so from the very day we were married, in my mind, I was thinking, we're sometimes going to have kids that we need to send to college, and we've been saving for a long time. And so we feel like we need to honor that commitment with Isaac. Now, when Levi comes around, we'll have to take a look at our finances at that point, but we're hoping that the market will come back and we'll still have our jobs.
These are not joke numbers. They can really break the bank. I mean, what private tuition costs these days is enormous, and no small number of public schools with pretty steep bills as well.
That's absolutely right. And a lot of readers are writing in and suggesting, well, why don't you send your kids to public schools? And in California, the public schools are quite a bit less expensive than the private schools, and yet those are really steep numbers that many families can't afford.
Stephen Yoder writes the Yoder and Son column with the Wall Street Journal. He and his son, 18-year-old son Isaac, and the whole family have been talking about where Isaac can and should go to school. Stephen, stand by there in San Francisco if you'd be good enough, and it's great to hear your voice again.
Sure.
Joining us now from New York is Jacques Steinberg. He is education reporter for the New York Times, author of The Gatekeepers, Inside the Admissions Process of a Premier College. Jacques Steinberg, thanks very much for being here.
Thank you, Tom.
And with us from Austin, Texas, is Alice Reinartz. She's Assistant Provost for Enrollment at Texas A&M University in College Station, Texas, ranked one of the top public universities in the country. Alice Reinartz, thank you very much for being here.
Thank you, Tom. It's a pleasure.
You've got a great big public university there. What are you seeing in these economic hard times, Alice, in patterns of application, in how you're thinking about who to admit?
Well, we are looking this year and in recent years. I would say I'm speaking not just for Texas A&M University, but perhaps many large public research universities, mm-hmm. at increasing applications in recent years. I think that the financial elements that you've been discussing certainly play a part in that. So we are becoming increasingly selective in that we are only able to admit the same number that we have in recent years. But at least for us in Texas, because of some situations here in our state, we've been able to keep our in-state tuition and even our out-of-state tuition pretty reasonable.
So still reasonable and strong applications, no doubt. Jacques Steinberg, you and others have observed that applications at public universities are up, I guess precisely because people are worried about paying those steep bills at private schools, Jacques.
It's certainly one of the reasons. We're actually, about a week and a half ago, the New York Times started a new blog that I launched called The Choice, and it's all about college admissions. And we have been flooded with comments from readers facing this very choice. Do they go to a public university where the tuition has been able to stay fairly stable? Or what about that private college that's also vying for them but that can't give them the same financial offer?
And Jacques, on the college side, this is a tough year as well because they don't know who's going to be able to afford to go where. Behavior may be very different from patterns they've seen in the past. They've got to end up with a class of 2013 that fits their facilities, that both fills their rooms but doesn't overflow in a kind of uncharted waters here, Jacques.
We tend to think of in this country that there's only four dozen or so highly selective private colleges. They're the ones that often get a lot of the ink. But there's actually more than 2,000 four-year colleges in this country. And a lot of them are going hat in hand to students, hoping that the students will choose them. And some of them could have a real problem if they don't get the yield, they don't get the class size that they were hoping for.
Alice, you know, all of this business inside and out, if you're sitting down with a family, you know, they've got a good student they want to send off to college, what kind of advice do you give them this year with the kind of economic constraints that everybody knows about out there, Alice?
Sure. I think the advice that I would give to a family, and hopefully earlier than
now,
the last year, yeah, is to look at a variety of options. At the very minimum, we would suggest to students to pick two or three schools to which they feel confident they will be accepted, one that would be more of a stretch, and then one that would be an absolute safety school. Now, that really relates to the admission element, but that has been affected in the sense that especially universities like ours that are more economical have more applicants, and therefore a student who several years ago would have been perhaps a lock on admission will have increasing competition now.
Stephen Yoder, you must have heard this as well from people who may have turned to public school now, may have counted on it all along, but it's tougher as more people try and pile in there for a little shelter in the economic storm, Stephen.
That's right, and out here in California, on top of that, the public schools are getting less funding. The classes are getting more crowded, and some students are now looking at not 4 years, but 5 years or 6 years to get the kinds of classes they need to get that degree. And so that needs to be plowed into that financial calculation as well.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about college decision time in hard times, tough choices and challenges this year with the economy flat on its back for students, families, and for colleges themselves. Stephen Yoder is with us from the Wall Street Journal, writes the Yoder and Son column there about parent and teen money issues. Jack Steinberg is with us from the New York Times, writes the Choice blog there, author of The Gatekeepers, and one of those, a big one, is with us. Alice Reinhartz joins us. She's assistant provost for enrollment at Texas A&M. 26,007 students applied there this year, record high, 8,100 expected to enroll. We've got a lot of callers. Let's go straight to some Lowell, Massachusetts. Faraz, you're on the air, Faraz.
Hi, Tom. How are you today?
I'm well. What do you know?
Well, Tom, 2 years back, you know, I have a 16-year-old son who is going to be going to college year after next. He's going to be a senior next year.
Yeah.
So a few years back, we had invested in a rental property, and, you know, our whole goal was we'll sell it and, you know, pay for the tuition.
Yeah.
And off this child goes to college. Well, next week I'm going to have a conference with the counselor to try to figure out what his options are in terms of college. He wants to be a veterinarian. You can only imagine what we're dealing with here, because we don't have that equity that was there in that house.
Mm-hmm.
We don't know how we're going to pay for this child's education, and we have absolutely no idea where the money has gone for all these stimulus packages, because we tried to do everything everybody wanted us to, and guess what? We weren't able to. But, you know, this whole thing is far more complex. I was thinking that my child's future may be at line unless in 12 months I can come up with the money to put him through school.
And what about your current income, Faraz? Has that been affected by the downturn?
Oh, absolutely. So I do mostly IT consulting. I own a small company that does contract work. We don't have any revenue. My wife stopped working a few years ago because we had children. So here we are. We weren't foolish in any way. As a matter of fact, you know, we're one of those people who has no credit card debt. Everything we have is either paid for or is in some kind of a real estate venture, which is backed by equity. So, ironically, even with all that astuteness, if I can call it that,
yep,
maybe not so astute at all, we're stuck in a situation where we're trying to figure out how, you know, how we're going to make this happen in the next 12 months.
For us, I'm sure millions of people can identify directly with what you're talking about. And Alice Reinhartz, let me put that story to you. It must have sound familiar, and you can imagine how it feels. They thought they had invested and done the right thing. That money is gone. 1 year to go, so they're 12 months out, and this father is already, you know, wringing his hands. And what's your advice?
Sure. Well, and it's ironic that he mentions veterinary study, since Texas A&M is one of the premier vet programs in the country.
Mm-hmm.
I think the advice is to start doing some serious just looking at the options. And all colleges now have excellent websites where you can compare programs and with great specificity look at the differences in the tuition and the cost of attendance. And you can often find a college, I believe, that is a good match, not necessarily one and only one university, but a good match that's still economical enough for the family.
What does Texas A&M cost now for out-of-state tuition?
Well, our in-state tuition, mm-hmm. which is, and because we are a state-supported school, mm-hmm. Is for a year, tuition and fees, $8,000. And so we're assuming that the entire cost of attendance for a state student would be around $20,000.
Mm-hmm.
Now, for out-of-state students, of which we have a modest number, the non-resident tuition and fees for a year is $23,000, with the cost of attendance at $35,000. But for students who come to Texas A&M and earn a competitive scholarship, mm-hmm. we waive their non-resident tuition. So, mm-hmm. frankly, Texas A&M and other Texas schools have been able to be much more economical while maintaining the excellence of our programs, both in terms of faculty numbers and also the variety of majors and so forth.
Jacques Steinberg, for this father, for us, and for others listening and parents right now, what about the financial aid situation out there? Direct aid, loans, how has the economic downturn affected that picture, Jacques?
Well, it's interesting if you're talking about highly selective private colleges. A lot of them have raised their financial aid budget this year. They've tried to cut everything but. They've let adjunct faculty go. They've sent administrators on furlough. This is the last thing they want to cut, and in fact, they are increasing it. But there is terrific advice to be had out there. This parent should not have to do this alone. Certainly start with the high school guidance counselor, who should have some knowledge of the basics, whether it's direct aid, scholarships, loans. But also, there's a terrific website called finaid.org, which is a great place to start. The founder of that, Mark Kantrowitz, is actually answering questions all this week on our blog, The Choice.
Mm.
And it's a very easy site for parents to navigate and to sort of get a hold of the basics. But they don't have to do this alone. It's complicated, but they also should not be daunted. There is a tremendous amount of financial aid out there if you know the right questions to ask.
But we've also read, Jacques, in your newspaper, that some colleges have had to tighten up on that, that there may now be an advantage in competing for admission if the admissions office looks down the page and sees that you don't need aid, that wealthier applicants may have another edge.
My colleague Kate Zernike had a front page story in the New York Times last week, and mm-hmm. which she said just that, that some of the need blind colleges, a very small group of colleges that has sort of pledged that we will admit you regardless of your ability to pay and we will meet your need, at least as we define it, that they are becoming more need aware. They look at the application. They can tell from the child's description of what the parents do whether this may well be someone who can pay full freight and perhaps sort of informally might look more favorably on that. But we have to remember that there are 2,000 four-year colleges in this country. It is not just the same four dozen or so highly selective privates or the state universities like Texas A&M that have such high name recognition. There are lots of options. And yes, you have to be prepared not to be able to swing your first choice or your second choice or maybe even your fourth choice. But everybody will get in somewhere terrific that they can afford.
Let's go to Windsor, Connecticut, and Liz. Hi, Liz. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I think it's great that this financial crisis is kind of focusing people's attention on public universities and community colleges.
Mm-hmm.
I went to the University of Connecticut myself,
great.
And I have a very manageable student loan, but I have friends who didn't focus on the cost of their education, whose parents and guidance counselors told them, go to the college that you really want to go to. And now that they're in their 20s and they have $50,000 to $100,000 in student loan debt,
yeah.
and their payments are not manageable, And, you know, we're, I think a lot of them are kind of wishing that they had gone to a public college or really focused more on the cost of their education and how they would pay for that down the line.
Yeah, absolutely. We hear that, Liz, and thank you for your call. Stephen Yoder, how about it? It was your message to your kids. We'll worry about the money later. But looking at your own family and beyond, Stephen, is that the right advice these days?
I don't think there is any single right piece of advice for any family. I still think it was the right advice for Isaac. I sometimes second-guess myself and wonder whether we ought to have included a broader web, including the public universities. But I think for a lot of families, it isn't the right advice, that they should look more broadly at public universities. We get a lot of mail from people saying that community colleges are really the best options for a lot of kids, because they can go there 2 years, transfer to a bigger university, come out with very little debt, and really get a better focused education.
Alice Reinhart, how about that? The community college, if money's really an issue, there's been a lot of growth there and a lot of excellent programs in community colleges. Do you see those do you advise students that, hey, go there, maybe start there and end up in a four-year school if that's what you want to do? Alice, what do you think of that path?
I think that's an excellent pathway for many students. We have a fairly transfer-friendly policy at Texas A&M, and so we do have a number of students who begin in community colleges and successfully graduate. Typically, it takes them just a little more than the four-year time to get a bachelor's degree, but generally only a semester more. And the expense being much less at community colleges and living at home. And then, frankly, some students are just a little more comfortable beginning a transition to a university environment or a college environment while being closer to their hometown. Mm-hmm. We have at Texas A&M about a quarter of our students in the freshman class who are first generation. And it is a major consideration for them to be going away from home.
Mm-hmm. It's a big deal on their radar when they're looking at their options.
Sure.
Let me take a call from John in Boston. John, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. How are you?
Good. What do you know?
Well, I'm at UMass Boston. I'm a senior. I'm actually in the parking lot right now about to run to class. But UMass Boston is a very diverse urban commuter school. And I really, one of the greatest things about the school is its diversity. Mm-hmm. And frankly, I'm worried that this economic downturn may actually threaten the social and economic composition of the school as more and more kids can't afford Boston University, Northeastern, whatever other private schools are in the city. They may apply to UMass Boston. And I was here this weekend taking a class, and in the parking lot there was some type of function for accepted students. And there were Mercedes and Land Rovers in the parking lot with parents bringing their kids in, the newly accepted students. And it was a really strange thing for me to see, and it kind of it made me a little bit anxious about the future of the school in the next few years.
The sense of a new profile there. Jacques Steinberg, how about it? If we see families that are or were more affluent piling into public schools, is there might that change the profile of those schools, diversity-wise, Jacques?
I mean, it might be different, but certainly UMass Boston is going to keep its eye on diversity, because that's one of these things that these colleges have committed to do. But I think this is the point where we should broaden the conversation a little bit, that there's been a raging debate in this country for decades about the difference between a name brand, Mercedes private school education and a far more affordable education at a place like UMass Boston or Texas A&M. At what point are you no longer able to justify the difference in tuition? Is that elite name on your resume really worth those tens of thousands of dollars of debt that you may have to go into to get it?
Stephen Yoder, your son Isaac has been thinking in a very sober-minded way about whether the colleges that he was thinking about still have the resources to give that really special education. A lot of endowments down by enormous percentages just in the last year. I mean, that's a real issue, Stephen.
That's right. In fact, it occurred to him a couple of weeks ago when teachers in California were getting their pink slips to think, well, gosh, how about some of the colleges I'm thinking of? Are some of the professors there getting pink slips? And so he did a quick search online to the college websites. And, of course, there's not much there. And so he started looking at college student newspapers to find information about who was getting laid off and what departments were getting trimmed back. And he began to worry that perhaps some of the programs that he's interested in at these colleges might be trimmed back. The flip side is those are probably the ones that will still have more financial aid. And so his interests sort of diverge from mine at a certain point.
But Jacques, surely nationally, I mean, a huge majority of students are going to public schools already. To your question about what we value in this country, not an awful lot of people already value that public university education, Jacques.
Absolutely. And it we've had this huge debate on the choice, the Times' college website. You can see we have six kids this month who are writing dispatches, not unlike Stephen's son, talking about choices they have to make. One student has a free ride at UConn, and yet she's pining for a few private colleges where she'd have to pay significantly more at great expense to her family. And to watch the comments underneath her post as people debate, take the free ride, are you crazy? Or, boy, that do you really want to be in Storrs, Connecticut? What would the UConn name do for you? The fact is, though, that a broad of course, as you say, a huge number of people are being educated at public universities and have gone on to terrific lives and careers. I think there are people that are being forced to think about this issue who might not have thought they would have had to a few years ago.
Let's get a call from Richard in Framingham, Massachusetts. Richard, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I went the first time around. I got my undergraduate degree. I finished in 1980. At a private school in the Midwest. I recently went back and got an MPH at Boston University and finished last year.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
The real difference was, you know, we have what's so-called diversity there at Boston University, but it's only skin deep. If you looked in the wallets of people, it was not all that diverse.
Meaning what, Richard?
We did not have socioeconomic diversity.
Meaning if you look in those wallets, you're going to see people, kids coming from families relatively well off.
That's correct. I think what we're developing is a new form of plutocracy here, because it does make a difference where you go to school or whether you go to school at all. And, you know, when I was in college, you know, we had truck drivers' kids there. We had farmers' kids there. I just don't see that as much anymore.
Ellis Reinhartz, how about it? You've got a different perspective there, maybe from Texas, and with one quarter of first-generation students, that says a lot in itself. But Richard worries about a new plutocracy in American universities, Ellis.
Well, all universities do think and talk about diversity all the time, and diversity has many elements, and socioeconomic is a really essential part of it. When I was listening to the conversations earlier, it strikes me from the public school perspective that the difference is between an elite education and an excellent education. And there may be significant regional impact here as well. The state of Texas, because we are less damaged so far, and I hope that remains.
Mm-hmm. Economically.
less damaged in the economy currently. Our faculty numbers are not shrinking, and our programs haven't been cut back, and we don't anticipate losing financial aid support. So it's possible that my perspective, being from Texas, is not what other public universities would have, but I certainly see that we're still a very good value and maintaining an excellent educational program.
Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking about college decision time in hard times this year. Tough choices this year for students, families, and for colleges themselves in the midst of a tough economy. Alice Reinhart is with us. She's assistant provost for enrollment at Texas A&M University. Jacques Steinberg's here from the New York Times, has the Choice blog there. Stephen Yoder's with us from the Wall Street Journal. He and his 18-year-old son, Isaac, write the Yoder and Son column on parent-teen money issues for the journal. And Isaac is headed off to school. Just where is not entirely clear yet. Here's from the website, onpointradio.org, Laura writes us, and she says that their son wanted to go to public university, couldn't find his major in state, applied and got in out of state, but it's going to add up to $40,000 a year, out-of-state tuition, public school. And now they've got their financial aid response from the school back. Yes, there's financial aid, but it's all loans, nothing else. They'll have to borrow. That's a lot of money. Jacques Steinberg, what's the profile? Who gets straight-up grants? Who has to go entirely to loans? And what about a family looking at that? You know, that's $160,000 plus right there, maybe, Jacques.
It is it's an increasing band within the middle class that is falling in this area where the aid is not direct. It's probably going to take another year for the full impact to be felt by the colleges themselves and passed on to kids. But there's no sugarcoating it. It's very, very hard.
Is there a number, a magic number of household income above or below which there's, you know, some kind of grant money, cash money, and not just the loan application, Jacques?
I think I may want to defer to Stephen on this. It's complicated. I mean, there are complicated formulas that that these institutions work off of.
Stephen, what do you know? What have you seen?
In terms of the cutoff in salary for
household income and who gets aid beyond loans?
Well, I can tell you that we don't get needs-based aid beyond loans. I'm not quite sure where the cutoff is.
Alice, is there anything you can say generically about that, or does it all depend on region and school?
Well, I can say this generically. Every student and family should fill out the FAFSA, F-A-F-S-A, which is an application for all kinds of available aid. Mm-hmm. And many families find that they qualify for some elements, whether it's a grant or perhaps a certain kind of student employment that helps offset tuition. And they didn't anticipate it. So it's just something not to miss, to make sure that each family fills out that form and works also with the financial aid people on the campus of their chosen university. Mm.
Jacques, let me ask you about this. Here's another comment from Glenn at the website. He says, I would sure like it if colleges would start reexamining their campuses and programs to cut costs. Most have a very high-class country club atmosphere replete with health clubs, selective dining, almost professional sports. I don't pay for this in my private life. I don't really want to pay for a luxury lifestyle for my college kids. Is that theme making the rounds, Jacques?
It is, and you know, Glenn would probably feel better late than never. There's no question that in this bid to preserve financial aid, among other things, at all costs, I think colleges, elite colleges, are finally examining this notion of to what extent, at what level of luxuries are these students sort of entitled? Is it possible to give them a world-class education without it being perhaps quite as comfortable as it has been? So those conversations are happening at campuses all over the country. I wanted to just one other point to make in response to the previous question. Mm-hmm. Another website to recommend is fastweb.com, which I believe is a free searchable site for lots of different scholarships that you might not otherwise know about.
Great. Fastweb.com. Let's go to Mary in Bluffton, South Carolina. Mary, you're on the air.
Thank you. Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I'm in my 50s, and I don't have any young adults at home, but mm-hmm. many of our friends over time have sent their students and sent their young adults to various colleges and universities and have paid exorbitant amounts of money on the tune of $40,000 or $50,000 a year. And we're talking average folks using the equity in their home to send their students there. And what I call this phenomenon is sort of an over-education of the average student. These are not students that are going to be doctors, lawyers, and dentists. They're just average students. When they get out of the college system after their families are in debt by $150,000 or $200,000. I have perfect examples of these students being insurance agents and working for Walmart. And I just wanted to get the opinion of the panel there is, what has happened to our culture? Why is it so? I mean, when I went to school, I went to City University of New York. I came out with a wonderful education. And I found that after a number of years, the employer wasn't looking at the school I went to, but my work contribution and my work experience. So I just want to get the opinion of the panel there and find out how valuable is the work experience. I think we kind of forget that issue as well.
It's a great observation and question, Mary. Stephen Yoder, how about it? Overeducation or just overspending? You know, have we sort of lost the proper ratio of bucks out the door and value on the other side?
Well, when you look at the price tags on these campuses, it does seem like the prices have gotten out of the range. We're looking at $40,000 to $48,000 a year. On the other hand, when we go in, you know, we're not thinking how can we best train Isaac to get a paying job at the other end. I went to a liberal arts college. I came out at the other end having no clue as to what I wanted to do, but I was prepared to find that after I left college, and I was prepared to find what suited me best. And that's one of the wonderful things about this country is you can get all the way through college, not know what you want to do, and still hit on a profession that suits you. And so I think that's a slight difference in how people view education going in the front end.
Jacques, do you still see that tradition alive in tough economic times? You know, get the good liberal arts education and then take that wisdom out into the world and find your career? Or are people too worried now to go down that path, looking for more career-oriented education even when they're undergraduates, Jean?
It'll be interesting to see what happens. I don't think we quite know yet. But again, I think this caller has touched on one of these great philosophical debates in this country. What is it we're going to these schools for? Like Stephen, I went to a terrific liberal arts college. There was not one journalism course offered there. And yet I came out of that college knowing how to think and how to ask questions and how to write. And that certainly helped me in the profession I decided to go into. We're also training citizens. How do you put a price tag on minting thinking, aware, thoughtful citizens? So I don't think it's all about vocational education quite yet for everybody.
Of course, but there's a lot of territory in between vocational education and elite private schools, and very good territory. Let's go to Paul in Nashville, Tennessee. Paul, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi, Paul.
I love your show. I'm a first-time caller.
Thank you. Good to have you.
I just wanted to recount a little bit my experience, which is similar to the previous caller. I did a PhD at a very highly ranked university, top 20 university private school in the U.S. News and World Report rankings.
Mm-hmm.
And I also teach at a prestigious private institution, but my undergraduate education was at a public institution, which is University of Maryland in College Park, and I absolutely cherish that undergraduate education that I had there. I had superb professors that I remember so fondly, and I really wouldn't have traded that experience for anything in the world. And I will also go so far as to say that I almost feel a little sorry for my students at the private institution where I teach now, because they do not have that experience of attending a public institution where it almost feels like you live in a big city where you have such an incredible diversity of people from all over the world and a socioeconomic diversity. And I almost feel like the students are missing out. And with those comments, I'll hang up and listen to the comments.
Paul, that's a very good balancing observation. And Alice, Paul must be singing your song there in a way.
Absolutely. I do think that it's important to consider both the in-class and the out-of-class experience and what the student himself or herself actually wants. Frankly, I often see students who are so influenced by what their parents want that it can sometimes change their own viewpoint. For a public university, the experience of being part of a large student group that does have that diversity, that does come together in service projects or in student organizations or in sporting events, musical performances, is an important part of their educational environment, and many of them will point to that every bit as much as getting the first job as the important thing that they wanted during that experience. Mm-hmm.
Jacques, you have written that, I mean, people are thinking about this in all different kinds of ways, but applications to the most expensive and elite schools are very much up this year. What's that about, Jacques?
I think we were slightly surprised about that, again, with the caveat that we all know there's 2,000 four-year colleges in this country. Last week, 8 of the most competitive colleges in this country, the colleges of the Ivy League, sent out their admission letters. And at almost all of them, the admission rate went down, in some cases quite a bit. Why did this happen? In part, there's probably something of a little bit of a delay that some of these families weren't quite feeling it in terms of the economy when they actually sent off these letters. In part, it's a lot easier to pay the $65 or so to apply to one of these schools and then figure out later if you can pay for it or not. But I think also there still is this notion that these educations are worth it, even for those who can't quite afford it right now, that there are so many things that you get as a result of that it's still can be rationalized as worth it.
But there's going to be a very critical eye on that presumption as long as these economic times last, I would think. But let's go to Reston, Virginia, and Michael. Michael, you're on the air.
Hi, everybody. How's it going?
Good. What do you know?
Well, I guess my concern is that since all these bubbles have burst and the activity of those bubbles supported has ceased and it's probably not going to return for a very long time, what does that mean for all these college grads that we've got coming through the pike, especially those who have been saddled with all this debt from the loans that they have? Any thoughts on that?
Great question. Stephen, you're with the Wall Street Journal. The bubbles burst. You know, not so long ago, some elite schools were sending almost half their classes into investment banking. That's not happening. Probably not going to happen again in the same way. So what about the economic value, immediate value of those educations, Stephen?
Well, then that goes back to my point early is I don't necessarily see college as something with economic value at the back end when Isaac and I are thinking of. But clearly this is something that college students have to think of. My older son, Luke, who's a sophomore mechanical engineering major and doesn't seem to have too much trouble finding work in the summer, says a lot of his classmates in the liberal arts and in business school are now fretting about what they might do and are thinking actually of moving into engineering and other fields that are more secure job-wise down the pike. You know, it's clearly something that we have to think about. It is something that I worry about with Isaac. If he goes through 4 years and gets a political science major, are there going to be any jobs at the other end?
Now, you and Luke have been writing just recently, Stephen, about the waiting list period that we're now in for a lot of colleges where students are dangling out there. And I guess, Stephen, that would be more complicated dance this year maybe than others because colleges are really juggling to make sure they fill their enrollment numbers and don't fall short or vastly overshoot, Steve.
Yeah, I suspect that's true. I think our other panelists here will know better than I, but I do get the sense that there probably are colleges are hanging on to their waiting lists a little bit longer because they aren't as sure who of their first choices are going to drop out for reasons that they might not have expected to when they first applied. And as I said earlier, we too are applying yardsticks, financial yardsticks that we wouldn't have back in September when we were first starting to apply.
Jacques, describe that dance for us that admissions offices are having to do now in juggling, you know, who's coming in and the flow to be sure that they end up with the right number.
Well, certainly anecdotally, there's evidence that schools are making their waiting lists longer. There's really no cost to a college to put a student on the waiting list. Obviously, there's some emotional cost for the student. You're being told now that you're neither rejected nor accepted. You're sort of in this weird period. But the waiting list for the students listening and for their parents, this is really a time, if you've gotten placed on a waiting list at a school that is your top choice or your second choice, this is really the time to let that college know. I mean, not in an annoying way necessarily, but certainly making clear that if accepted, you will go if that happens to be the case. And if accepted, I will go, but I'm going to need this. I think you have to make that clear too, and you might be surprised at the answer that comes back. But this is not a time to be shy and retiring. This is a time to sort of make your argument and let them know of your interest.
Alice, it sounds like your ranks are filling no problem, but we've got schools out there really beating the bushes. I'm reading here Santa Clara University, its president, its provost, and 400 alumni volunteers are phoning each and every admitted student to encourage them to enroll. Here's California Lutheran University. You know, everyone who's admitted will get a note from someone of common interest or geographic backgrounds. Colleges don't want to be caught short this year, Alice.
Well, for those of us who are in the admissions offices, hitting the right yield is absolutely something that we have to worry about.
That is the number of students who actually end up matriculating, enrolling.
The number who actually enroll. And for me and for many of my colleagues, our question to our president is often, if we're going to miss, do we miss a little high or do we miss a little low? Because in our case, we'll have around 8,000 freshmen, and you can't hit it exactly. So we are looking to the wait list to try to balance that number a little more closely.
It's a complicated year and a complicated picture. We wish very good luck to everyone who's right in the middle of it. And I guess, first of all, Stephen, to your son Isaac, our fingers are crossed that things work out just right for him and for your family budget. Stephen, thank you very much for being with us this hour.
Thank you, and thank you for your thoughts.
Stephen Yoder, San Francisco Bureau Chief for the Wall Street Journal, writes the Yoder and Son column. Jacques Steinberg at the New York Times with the Choice blog there. Jacques, thank you very much for your insights today.
Thank you.
And Alice Reinhart's Assistant Provost for Enrollment at Texas A&M. Alice, just great to have you. Good luck, and thanks for joining us.
It's a pleasure. Thank you so much.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.